This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Dry January got its start in Britain and has been gaining in popularity there. And it's a steadily growing movement in the U.S. as more people start the new year with a commitment to swear off alcohol for 31 days. Joining us to discuss the benefits and the drawbacks of dry January are Director of Clinical Services with the Center for Addiction Treatment, Michelle Pritchard, Professor and Vice Chair for Clinical Research in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Dr. Cal Adler, and Dr. Nadeem Anwar, Associate Professor in the UC College of Medicine Division of Digestive Diseases and a UC Health Physician. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dr. Anwar, thank you for being here today. And Dr. Adler, thank you. And Michelle, thank you for being here as well. So your thoughts on the idea of dry January, do you see any benefits to doing this? Cal, we'll start with your thoughts.
You know, so I'm a psychiatrist, so everything's yes and no. Mostly no.
Mostly no.
Well, so there are some benefits, right? So it's never, for many people, this may be perhaps the genesis of being more aware of their drinking. And that can be a positive thing. It can perhaps give them some experience with decreasing, let them know that they can. In a sense, I think of this as like a New Year's resolution, essentially. And New Year's resolutions
we
often
know how often those get broken.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, they get a bad rap, but they're not a terrible thing because they provide a backstop, right? You keep putting off. It provides a time to, okay, actually do it. And if this gives you the impetus to perhaps try to decrease your drinking, that might be a good thing. But, and I think Michelle is probably going to talk more to this than I, but there's some real downsides here too. There's the potential for a rebound. Okay, I'm done January. Thank God I can pick up the bottle again. And you may end up drinking more. And I wouldn't want anyone to have the illusion that it's really doing very much, the 1 month off, other than kind of giving you some experience or just giving you the idea that you that one can, which is not necessarily trivial, but it's not going to be a cleanse and change your life. I mean, I don't love the idea of cleanses anyway. But I suppose if you go into a cleanse, there are worse things. It's probably better than a colonic. So that's a positive.
Okay. Would you think that this is better than doing nothing though about your drinking problem?
So assuming you're not someone who is such a problematic drinker that there's a question of withdrawal, I mean, obviously, if you're someone who is at risk for withdrawal, alcohol withdrawal can be fatal, can be, you know, extremely serious. But assuming that's not the case, then, right, it's not terrible if it gives somebody the impetus to think about addressing their drinking in a serious way. As long as it's not oversold. My concern is that I think it has gained a unwarranted momentum or an unwarranted people putting too much stock in what it's likely to do. And you may find people getting disappointed then or feeling like, well, what's the point? Because I stopped drinking for a month and my face hasn't cleared up. You know, my social life hasn't improved. All my medical problems have not magically disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, want to get your thoughts on dry January.
Yeah.
benefits and potential pitfalls that you see.
Yeah, so I see it just as a super trendy thing that's happening right now. And, you know, I don't have too much more to add to what Dr. Adler already said. But we look at this as a time of where people can learn how to develop new coping skills. So to realize that I don't need alcohol maybe to deal with a hard day or to have fun with my friends, that there's other things that I can do in order to find enjoyment in life or to cope with some things that are going on. The other thing is that life is all about balance. So, you know, I would prefer to teach people more about how can I drink in a manner that's safe for me or how can I learn how to manage my drinking so I'm not, you know, Dr. Adler said the binge word, so I'm not binge drinking. So I'm doing things in a more safe, balanced manner. And in society, we want to do things all or nothing.
We want it fixed right now.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Is that part of the danger of this is that people think, oh, if it's that easy, I just quit for a month, I'm out of the woods. Is it maybe looking at it too simplistically, Dr. Anwar?
Let me say this, that I am a liver specialist, so I see patients when they've had more than just mild or moderate amount of drinking done, and they've received alcohol-related damages, and they are at a point where they are thinking about possibility of transplant or worse. So I don't preach stopping for a little bit because to me, as Dr. Adler said, stopping for a little bit doesn't really do in the long term any benefit to these patients. I preach to those patients total sobriety if they want to live. So this dry January, you know, is probably more pertinent if I would say somebody's going to consider doing it for patients who are moderate drinkers and then on those people, if they want to quit for a month, they may get some brief temporary benefit out of it. And then if they go back to their own, and plus if they were planning to do this in the month of January, would there be a reactive binge drinking before going into that dry spell like people would sometimes expect? So they end up getting more damage to the liver than benefit out of it. So one episode of binge drinking, 4 or 5 drinks in one setting, will lead to fatty liver disease. So the fatty liver changes start to happen with one episode of that. So
and fatty liver disease is what? It's the starting point of worse liver disease?
It's the starting point. The liver disease is alcoholic liver disease is a spectrum ranging on one end with fatty liver disease, which is benign, most cases reversible, to the other extreme, which is advanced decompensated liver disease with a possibility of liver cancer. So that's the other end. So the fatty liver disease, the first part is reversible if you stop. But you know, I mean, these are the patients who've been drinking for more than 10 years, more than moderate quantities on a daily basis. So if you ask me whether binge drinking has any advantages, I say it has the same amount of advantage that you would ask somebody who's a smoker to stop smoking for a month and then go back to it, or ask somebody who has diabetes to manage their diabetes better for a month and then go back to their old ways. The one advantage I can think and see in all of this is if they can go without alcohol for a month, one would hope they would think that there is life without alcohol and become moderate or less than moderate drinkers going forward. And it could be in preparation to try to quit alcohol rather than just doing it for a month and then going back to their usual ways. And as Dr. Adler said, celebrate on February 1st in a big way.
Mm. So. How long does it take for the liver to process alcohol? How long does it take for it to clear out of the...
So alcohol follows what we call zero-order kinetics, which means the metabolism is dependent upon the quantity of alcohol that's absorbed, not based upon the size of the person. So it's about 100 milligrams per hour, per kilogram per hour is metabolized. So if you drink more, it takes longer to get out of your system. If you drink less, it'll get out sooner. So if somebody has one unit drink of alcohol, it'll take about 90 minutes to get out of their system.
Mm-hmm. But the long-term effects, if somebody quits drinking, how long does it take for the liver to start to just to bounce back from that?
Okay, so that's a good question. The fatty liver disease, which is the earlier part, which is the reversible part of the disease, but 4 to 5 weeks, it can show some improvement.
Okay. So the month might help you, but then it depends, like you were saying, Dr. Adler, what do you do after the month?
Yeah.
I'd like your thoughts on people who go online, they post online how easy this might be. You know, they say, oh, this was simple. I had no trouble doing this. Is that going to hurt somebody who maybe is struggling with alcohol if they see that and they think, well, it's hopeless. I can't change. There's nothing I can do about it. This guy had it easy, but I'm not having it easy.
Yeah, I don't think it's helpful. Obviously, we all vary with how difficult it's going to be to give up drinking or smoking or anything. From some people have no difficulty at all to some people for whom it's going to be a struggle and in some cases a losing struggle, that people with serious medical problems still can't stop drinking because of the nature of their addiction. There's this range. And I think you're absolutely right that if we're bombarded with messages that this is easy, it can be discouraging. and people can just give up. And it's part of what I think of as the, well, we used to call it the Christmas card phenomena, and now I guess it's the Facebook phenomena, where nobody ever really gets on and talks about how bad their life is or how bad things are. Right? Everything's great. You know, on Facebook, everything's great. The old Christmas cards, everybody's got a happy family. You know, I did this, and my skin cleared up, and it was easy. And, of course, in comparison, we look at our own lives, and everything seems much, much darker. And so I would worry that when people read about how easy this is and how life-changing it was for other people, it's going to be discouraging, and it's going to make some people less apt to quit.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, what do you think about that?
You know, I think, too, everybody's kind of been hinting at it. There are different people with different ranges and levels of their drinking. So, you know, we have people who are maybe they're weekenders or they're, you know, social people who are just drinking with friends. I really wouldn't consider that for most people problematic drinking. You know, we have it from a huge spectrum all the way to the left and all the way to the right to what Dr. Anwar is talking about, some people with some serious drinking problem who have serious now cirrhosis of the liver and need a transplant or something like that. So we're talking about different levels of people, so there's going to be different ranges of how hard or difficult it's going to be for certain people. So some people who's social drinkers, it's like, yeah, it's not that big a deal, you know, to go to a month, but you have somebody who's a serious alcoholic, and yeah, they look at that, but you can't compare yourself to somebody who's just a social drinker compared to somebody who's a serious alcoholic and drinks, you know, 10 beers a day, every day, and has for years. You know, you can't compare yourself to those types of people. So
if you struggle with this, if not drinking for 4 months is a problem, is that a sign that you've got a problem with alcohol? For sure?
I'm sorry.
Is that a for sure sign? I mean, if you struggle to do this, is that a for sure sign that you have a problem with alcohol?
Not necessarily. Okay. I mean, it's one of the indicators. So, you know, if you want to control or cut down or stop your drinking, if you've thought about that before, that's one of the indicators that maybe you might have a problem drinking. But there's so many more than that. So to make like diagnostic criteria, that's only one of the eight, you know, that we're looking for in order to diagnose somebody with a condition. So, but it is definitely one of those little red flags that says you have that compared with some, you know, some other things like difficulty in gauging another social interaction. So like you want to drink in every area, you know, you're having difficulty fulfilling work obligations or school obligations or family function type stuff due to your alcoholism, you know, that there's a problem there or, you know, tolerance, you need to continue to use more, withdrawal, craving, all of those kind of things paired together start to put some, you know, picture of problem drinking and red flags for people.
What about the peer pressure? A lot of people say they go to parties and they're not going to drink, and the other people there are like, well, why? Why aren't you drinking? I mean, but what role does that play?
It plays a role, but I think it's even more subtle than that. I mean, alcohol, like a lot of things, has a strong social contagion effect, meaning you're more likely to drink if the people around you are drinking. It's normalized. It's part of what people do. So if you tend to hang out with people who drink, you will tend to drink. And that can have a really strong effect. So you mentioned this came out of England. England's a good example of that. People drink more on average in England. It's accepted. And in fact, one of the oft-cited studies, we were talking about this earlier, about the potential benefits of this come from 10 people from this one magazine. But what was really interesting is they said none of the people were problem drinkers, but many of them drank from 40 to 80 units a week of alcohol. 80 units a week, I mean, that's over 11 drinks a day every day. Kind of sounds like a problem drinker to me. But in England, apparently, that's just a day at the pub. So that there's a social aspect to this. And that can make it hard to stop if you're around people who are drinking and were just part of the culture. And that might be one of the areas where this really is beneficial, where you don't necessarily have a problem in that you can't stop, but it just never really occurred to you to because you're surrounded by people who drink a lot. And if this normalizes perhaps not drinking so much, it might allow you to decrease your
alcohol. You're talking
about
using dry January as an excuse. You go to a party and say, it's dry January. I'm not touching anything for the next 4 weeks.
And if enough people are doing it, it normalizes it. It might make it easier to decrease and kind of fight that social contagion to some degree. I mean, for what it's worth, the National Health Service in England, where this is bigger, has recommended against dry January. They instead recommend trying to stop drinking for 2 or 3 days in a given week and extend that, of course, beyond 1 month, rather than trying to do a month that they felt was more helpful to kind of decrease the daily drinking as the first step towards cutting back.
Why would they suggest that? Is it just easier in terms of withdrawal? You're not going to go through the same kind of withdrawal if you just do it in smaller steps like that?
Well, I think this is geared for people who aren't in withdrawal. Once withdrawal is an issue, there's a whole nother – I mean, it's a medical – potentially a medical emergency. You need to be careful. And you could go in withdrawal in just a couple of days. So that wouldn't necessarily rule out withdrawal. But it's a more realistic way of trying to decrease than saying, okay, I'm not going to drink at all for a month. One, that's harder to do. Two, how useful is it, particularly, again, if you take up drinking again in February? It's not really a lifestyle change. Whereas decreasing your drinking so that 2 or 3 days in the week you don't drink, you don't go to the pub, or you drink non-alcoholic drinks at the pub, is something that's potentially more sustainable and that you could then expand.
And Dr. Anwar, when you're talking with your patients about drinking, how do you advise them to cut back? What do you usually tell them?
The first thing I tell the patients is that I know it's a disease. Once you tell them, they kind of relax and they realize that you know what they're going through. I empathize with them because I know it's a medical disease like any other disease. So some of them are able to cut back slowly on their own. Some of them need to be in a substance abuse treatment program. And for my purposes, for liver transplant and all going in those directions, we encourage for the patients to be in an alcohol substance abuse treatment program. And that's also a part of it. It is because it's a requirement for the patients to be considered for transplant to be at least in a program for 3 months to qualify for consideration for liver transplantation. Oftentimes, it's easier to be in a program in a supervised setting, be it as it may, most likely in an outpatient setting. It makes things easier for them to quit. It's hard to quit cold turkey, so obviously they will need to be washed. And if they're drinking heavily and they're going to stop, they may need an inpatient detox in the beginning and then moving on to more an outpatient rehab or consolidation of the therapy. But I think this whole dry January is not designed towards high drinker, high volume drinkers. I think it's mostly designed, or people who are doing it are the ones who are doing moderate or less than that amount of drinking. Patients who are drinking excessively, and excessively, the definition of excessively also changes. The American Association for Study of Liver Disease says men, if they drink more than 21 drinks a week, and women who drink more than 14 unit drinks a week are considered high volume drinkers. So these are the patients who will have the most difficulty quitting on their own cold turkey. So these are the ones who either need...
They'd be better off seeking help then.
That's correct.
Yeah. Michelle, what about for people who are battling alcoholism, or meetings like AA meetings, are those useful?
Yeah. Those meetings are great. And I think they're just one tool that people can use. A lot of things that are great about it is that support and that community. Dr. Anwar used the word empathy and being able to understand everybody that kind of understands each other. So for people who don't understand, why can't you just put it down? Why can't you just stop? It just seems, it was easy for me in dry January when I just put down my drinks. And it's not easy for people who have alcoholism and have that brain disease. So
no, it's not just a matter of willpower, is it?
No, it has nothing to do with that, essentially. So being around people who all understand and all get that daily struggle, sometimes that minute-to-minute struggle, that craving of wanting to use, it's just wonderful to be around that and to be supported by people. That network of people is so amazing and so strong. They can be complete strangers and get each other's cell phone numbers and pick each other up for meetings and just be able to provide each other support that we don't see anywhere else in really any other type of community or social group. So that is one really great tool for people to use is the AA community.
Yeah. So if you're going to try to quit drinking, it sounds like what Michelle is saying is true. You need to do this as part of a group.
I think so, but I think Dr. Anwar made a really good point in that we're lumping drinkers together to some degree, and I think that's a mistake. So
everybody's different, and yeah.
Right. So Michelle is talking about individuals who have, you know, addiction, mm-hmm. where as opposed to individuals who might not have the addiction but might be drinking more than is good for them. Could be for a lot of reasons. Again, it could be because they're in a social group where there's a lot of drinking. Could be a habit. Could be a cultural issue. And of course, they're going to be very, very different. But for individuals who are battling addiction, you know, I can only echo what Michelle said, that kind of support group can be critical. And in a sense, you are recreating a new social group and one in which not drinking is the acceptable norm. And that, again, can be very helpful.
What would be your advice? What's the first step someone should take if they want to reduce how much they drink, if they want to eventually get to the point where they're just not drinking anymore, period?
Well, it would depend on the individual. So if it's someone who has a history of being unable to stop or stopping and relapsing, particularly with some medical consequences of the use, where there's some evidence for addiction, then ideally I would seek treatment. I would get involved with an addiction therapist with a program like Cat House, who can work with you to put in place the kind of structure that you're going to need. And in fact, if you're someone who's got a history of withdrawal from alcohol, you know, DTs or seizures, then you're really going to need medical guidance to limit the possibility of that being a problem. If you're someone who doesn't have a problem or doesn't seem to have had a problem with addiction, but you'd like to decrease your amount of alcohol, then what I would say is you'd want to do it gradually. Gradually decrease the amount, you know, maintain some increased control, and also reach out to establish kind of a strong social support network to help you do that.
Thank you, everybody, for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Director of Clinical Services with the Center for Addiction Treatment, Michelle Pritchard, Professor and Vice Chair for Clinical Research in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, Dr. Cal Adler, and Dr. Nadeem Anwar, Associate Professor in the UC College of Medicine Division of Digestive Diseases and a UC Health Physician.